We've had a change in local political party leadership in Lake County. Jim Weiser is the new chairman of the Lake County Democratic Party, and he joins us from his law office in Schererville to talk about the changeover. Jim, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. It's good to be with you.
Tell us the reason that you decided to become a candidate and end up getting selected to become the new Democratic Party chairman.
The choice is kind of an unusual one, I guess. It happened sort of in mid-November. There was a group of us, some elected officials and others, speaking, just talking about the state of the party, about our concerns locally, nationally, at the state level. And several people were saying they thought that the next leader of the local party should be a non-elected official. And that's a position, quite frankly, I've held for a long time. I mean, that was my stance. Mm-hmm. I thought that someone who was non-elected could devote all of their time and energies to and focus on the party and the development of the party as opposed to worrying about their own office or their own campaign funds or their own campaign reports and things of that nature. So as we talked, several people suggested, why don't you think about doing it yourself? And I said, no, I don't think that's what I'm going to be doing. But the more I thought about it and the more I started talking to people, the more I thought it was a viable approach. I've been involved in the party my whole career here. I'm a former elected official, former party attorney, election board attorney. So I've run campaigns from presidential campaigns to precinct committeeman campaigns, and I have a good sense of what I think of what it takes, and I've got, I believe, strong relationships with people, so I threw my hat in the ring.
Now, we know that the decision that you got to become the next Democratic Party chairman to some seemed rather contentious because, of course, it involved John Buncich, our Lake County sheriff, who unfortunately is facing criminal charges and filed in federal courts on him. He's stepped aside now. He has his hands full, I think, running the sheriff's department with the issues that he has to deal with there, I imagine. Probably it's wise to have turned over the party chairmanship to someone else. I know that there were some people who were very unhappy about the decision that Mike Repay. There's some people very unhappy about that. Do you think that some of the maybe bad feelings at the time of the caucus when the decision was made to put you in as the county Democratic chairman have kind of been set aside?
I really do, Chris, and I'll tell you why. First of all, well, let me just say this. People have said, you know, it looked like that it appeared contentious, and it was. We contended. Mike and I never had a problem with each other. But I think what it reflects, and a lot of people say, well, that's going to cause or drive a wedge in the party or disunity. And I disagree. I think what it reflected was that there were two good candidates, high-quality candidates, that had a different approach with good ideas and varying ideas. And it got a lot of people interested. We had 625 people show up at that caucus, at that reorganization meeting. Nobody can remember the last time that many people, that many committeemen and vice committeemen showed up. And I think they showed up because there were good candidates and that had good platforms and programs. It just so happened that ultimately I prevailed. But to get more to the specifics of the question, I immediately, we were fortunate in that I had talked to Jeff Chittister, the first district chairman from Porter County, who indicated that he had a commitment and he was going to honor the commitment if I was elected chairman, that the next district chairman would be from Lake County. So I immediately went to Mike after the vote. I said, you're the guy for the job, Mike. I think we should go tell Jeff right now that I'd like to see, that Lake County would like to see you be the first district chairman because you bring a lot of energy, you bring a younger generation, you bring some great ideas, you're a county official. It's an ideal spot. And we were fortunate enough to be able to do that. And so Mike now sits in that role, and in that role, he gets very involved with the state party. And in fact, last Saturday voted on the state chairmanship. And that gives Lake County just another additional benefit to in our relationship with the state party and to move forward, and also helps repair any issue there may have been or in reference to the election. So I think everything's working out so far. It's only been a couple of weeks, but I think it's working out really well.
Well, and you mentioned here about the fact that the Democratic Party of the state of Indiana is going to have their hands full here. They have the aftermath of the November general election and the sweeping into office of more Republicans, save for one here in Lake County. And a lot of Republicans, of course, voted for Donald Trump, got him elected as president. And we know that now that the Democratic Party has statewide and nationwide has a lot of work to try to rebuild and see what they can do to counter all that pressure that they're going to face now from the Trump administration. You think that that Indiana is ready to make the changes, and in turn Lake County is able to make the changes needed in the Democratic Party to be able to plan for the future?
Oh, I do. I certainly know that we are locally. We do have, Chris, some significant work to do with the infrastructure of our own local party. And we've already begun that process. And I think that that's going to be very successful. Both Mike and I and my executive board, we're committed to growing the party, and we're committed to reaching out to those who may not have felt that they were either being heard or that they were welcome necessarily in the party. We're the young Democrats have gotten much stronger, and we're using that organization to help build the youth in our party. We're reaching out to the progressives, I guess, for lack of a better term, those that were very active in the Bernie Sanders campaign, that bring a ton of energy to the issues and help us focus on major, you know, bigger picture issues while we're building the party from within. And I think that this year is a non-election year. I am focused on getting the party brick by brick, getting this party rebuilt, making sure we have strong precinct organizations, and we do. We have some great people in our precinct organization. I got reminded of that by all the campaigning I did and met the hundreds of chairmen and precinct captains and precinct committeemen and vices, and we've got a good group of people. We're really going to build on that so that next year in the 2018 elections, we'll be ready to rock and roll.
I'm talking to the new Lake County Democratic Party chairman, Jim Weiser, chosen by a reorganization caucus recently to take the spot that John Buntzich had been holding. Jim, do you think that, and you mentioned now what did you looking ahead to 2017 and the work that's going to be done to kind of reorganize, revitalize the Democratic Party, and not only in Lake County but across the state of Indiana. You mentioned some of the things that people were concerned about not paying attention, and perhaps in the past year or years, I guess, to those out there who might have been strong supporters of the party and maybe had been in the past, and you've got, of course, as you mentioned, young Democrats that should be brought into the fold as well, too. Are there any other things that you've had a chance to note here in passing that had happened or maybe didn't happen in 2016 and going into 2017 that you want to be sure that they get covered?
Well, you know, there's a broad picture here, Chris. I keep struggling with the idea that somehow a non-political billionaire who I don't think is very well focused and quite frankly well suited for the job, but he was elected, somehow tapped into the frustration that people in the middle class have felt, that I think we lost sight of as Democrats, the frustration they felt, especially here in Northwest Indiana, by the over the years, the retirees losing some of their pension, losing their health benefits, and how upset they are at the malaise and just the gridlock that goes on in Washington. And I think I think as Democrats, we kind of lost focus of that. Those are our folks. That's our base. And they were frustrated and they were angry, and we didn't offer the alternative that they needed. And Trump offered it. In my humble opinion, he'll never be able to perform on it because I don't think that's what really his drive and his focus is. But they picked up on it. And we have to get back to those people, to that group, specifically that group, and say, look, we understand. We know what you're talking about, and we're going to work night and day for you, and to help bring about a minimum wage, a livable minimum wage, to help increase your living, to help increase and improve the wage structure in Indiana. I think we're, 38th in the country mm-hmm. in lack of increase in wages over the last 20 years. That's what we need to focus on.
I know that people like long-noted and experienced economist and speaker and writer, Mort Marcus, have said even in a recent column that he's put out here about the fact that there are people in Indiana that won't face the facts that Indiana actually has been in pretty sad economic shape for quite a long time. Maybe that even goes back to the years after the Civil War, when things started changing after the war and things started continuing to change. But unfortunately, it was into the 70s and the 80s that things got even worse, in particular here in Northwest Indiana. Do you think also, too, that if in bringing the factions that had been out there of the Lake County Democratic Party together, that you find yourself in maybe a little better position, perhaps, than some counties in Indiana, where their Democratic Party organization is still kind of trying to see what they can do to make up for the losses?
Oh, I absolutely do, Chris. The folks here in Northwest Indiana, they just need to see that there's a caring leadership, and that we are committed. We are committed to making the party better, and we're committed, therefore, hopefully, to make people's quality of life better, and that we can get the job done, and that we will get it done. I mean, you know, I'm looking at what's going on in Washington, and I think about our local area and all the issues that we have about redevelopment and brownfield development, and now all of a sudden the EPA is being proposed to be cut by a third or 40%, and social programs are going under the axe while we continue to pour, or at least under the budget proposal, billions and billions of dollars into the military that, to me, is neglecting what our real issues are, particularly, as you said, in Indiana. And I think here in Northwest Indiana, we get it. We get it a lot better, and I think the Democrats get it a lot better. And I know with the support of labor, we're going to reach out to the business community. I think that's a community we've overlooked for some period of time. We're going to put things back together, and you're right, Chris. It isn't that difficult because we all know what we want to get done. It's just a matter of putting everybody together and getting it done.
Jim Weiser is the new Democratic Party chairman here in Lake County. Jim, thank you for taking time to talk with us. Your reflection on how things have gone in 2016 from the result of the elections, and looking ahead to spending the year a rebuilding mode, I guess. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome, Chris. Anytime.
A new direction for the Catholic Church may be on the horizon. Pope Francis has expressed an openness to the idea of married priests to deal with the shortage of priests. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore has some local reaction.
In an interview in a German newspaper, Pope Francis says he would entertain the possibility of ordaining married men as priests. Quote, "We need to think about whether tested men could serve as priests." Pope Francis says the issue of the shortage of priests is an enormous problem. According to the Pope, these men could be used in remote areas. In an article in the New York Times, they quote the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate as saying in the United States there are now about 2,500 Catholics per priest. In Brazil, the center says, there are roughly 8,000 Catholics per priest. At St. Mary of the Lake Catholic Church in the Miller section of Gary, parishioners seem open to the idea.
Well, there's a priest at St. Paul's who was married before, and I think he's a wonderful priest. I think priests probably learn a lot about life just from their experiences with their parishioners and their education and through people making confessions. I think they know a lot about life. I don't think you need to be married to, to do that.
I think it would be wonderful. We've lost so many good people because they left to get married. And you have two people then, too. You have the wife helping, and it's just, I don't see any reason not to.
But I think if the opportunity for priesthood were broadened, I think that would be a great thing.
I know a lot of married Catholic men who have deep faith, and I think they'd be great priests.
At St. Mary's, they are all too familiar with the problem of the shortage of priests. Currently, Bishop Melchick is the pastor.
We had one of the ladies of the parish kept things going, and we had Father Mick Copel, who was also rector of the cathedral, was kind of an overseer, and then they depended upon visiting priests, usually retired, coming in, or like from the Salvatorian Fathers coming in on Sunday. We have other instances, Holy Trinity Croatian Parish in East Chicago. They have that kind of arrangement to this day, and it works okay for them.
We had rotating guest priests that would come to basically do Mass for us, and we were lucky that we had that opportunity, but with having the rotating priests, it did make it hard to develop relationships and to consistently rely on different leaders for our different church events and our needs. There were definitely challenges associated with that, and obviously it is a nice opportunity to actually have a priest, you know, here full time who can reach your people's needs, whether it's visiting the sick. I do think it is beneficial to parishes to have a priest that they can call their own on a full time basis.
Retired Bishop Melchick says this is not a new idea for the Catholic Church.
We have exceptions already. A number of Protestant ministers have become Catholic. They're married, have children, and we have even ordained them. And they're functioning in parishes now. So we do have some married priests functioning in the United States. And all the apostles, as far as we know, except John, were married. John was not married.
There you go.
So,
but it's a new world. And I think a lot of people, younger people, have distanced themselves from the church because of rules and rarities. So, you know, it might be a new beginning for the Catholic Church if they allowed it.
This news gives hope to people who someday hope that the role of women in the church might also be expanded. Bishop Melchick says while women's role is vital, that they will not become priests. That issue, he says, has been settled. In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Hundreds of faith leaders got together at the Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis last week for a day of workshops that are focused on fighting poverty. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin met up with one of the event's speakers to talk about a central theme of the conference, the role of social service programs in people's lives.
Damon Lynch is a pastor from Cincinnati, Ohio, and he thinks there's a fundamental problem with the way most social service agencies approach their work in poor communities. For years, Lynch lived and worked in a Cincinnati neighborhood called Over the Rhine.
For a long time, it was one of the most impoverished communities in the state of Ohio. So God saw fit to put me down there to pastor for 23 years, and I fell in love with the people.
Lynch says the prevailing goal for most service agencies in Over the Rhine was to provide poor residents with things they needed. But he says despite having access to a wide variety of services, like drop-in centers, soup kitchens, and food pantries, its residents remain some of the poorest in the state.
At some point, you wake up and say, obviously servicing people does not make them whole. So we have the most service community and yet the poorest community, the most crime-ridden community at the same time.
For Lynch, the answer is what's called asset-based community development. His favorite analogy for explaining it is a half-full cup of water. The water represents everything people have in a poor neighborhood, and the empty part represents what they need. He says social services focus almost entirely on that emptiness, ignoring the potential for real community growth and leaving many people to believe that they're nothing more than their problems. To illustrate the point, Lynch tells the story of a man who showed up in his neighborhood office one day. The man had been stabbed in the arm with a screwdriver, and he wanted pain medicine.
So he comes up to my office, and he slouches down and proceeds to give me the saddest story you ever want to hear. He's from down south somewhere, came to Cincinnati, thought he'd have a better life. Somebody stabbed him trying to rob him. So at some point, I said, tell me what you do and what you do well. And he said, I lay floors. I said, what kind of floors? He said, linoleum, hardwood, tile, you name it, I can lay it. Now, as he says, I lay floors, he starts to sit up straight. And I'm watching this guy grow right in front of me. At the end of the conversation, I send him back downstairs to my secretary to do whatever it is she does. She called upstairs and said, "What did you do?" I said, "What do you mean, what did I do?" She said he left here crying and said he had forgotten that he was a man.
While stories like this explain how Lynch cemented his belief in asset-based development, what ended up happening to Over the Rhine might explain his passion. Starting in 2011, the neighborhood went through a dramatic transformation. It was gentrified, home now to sushi restaurants, microbreweries, and Belgian waffle cafes. Lynch says the change was seen by many others as a great success.
We didn't eradicate poverty in Cincinnati, we just moved it. And I mean, it's a totally, totally different place, but the poor people are gone.
He's quick to point out that this is not an argument against the existence of social service agencies, just an argument against how they operate. For the glass of water to get full, he says, it needs to be filled from the inside. And Lynch says in many ways the faith community has become just another social service agency, not only making some of the same mistakes, but also neglecting core biblical lessons like this one from the New Testament.
Jesus was preaching one day and there's like 5,000 or more people there, and the disciples say, "Hey, they're hungry, send them away." He says, "We don't send people away, we're going to feed them." Now, he's Jesus. He could have just said, "All right, we're going to feed them. Father, I need manna from heaven and quail to fall down because these people don't have anything. So if you would just send some stuff and we'll feed everybody." No, he says, "What do we have?" And that has to be the question. What do we have?
Lynch is no longer in Over the Rhine. He works now with faith leaders around the country to push for growing communities and the people in them with the assets they already have. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dodlin in Indianapolis.
At the State House, one of the controversial measures to come up before lawmakers this session is Senate Bill 309. It's a bill sponsored by James Merritt and others in the Indiana Senate, and co-sponsored in the Indiana House by a Republican from Valparaiso, Ed Soliday. It would slash the reimbursement rates that schools, churches, businesses, and homeowners get from utilities for selling the power that they would make from solar panels that they've installed at their homes or their facilities back to the electric companies. Representative Soliday's committee is going to hold a hearing on the measure on Wednesday, and there's quite a bit of opposition already to it. One of the opposition members is the Hoosier Environmental Council. And with us, we have the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Jesse Carbonda, with us. Jesse, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Always good to be with you, Chris.
Tell us a little bit of why the HEC is very concerned about Senate Bill 309.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head as far as the most important element of this of great concern, which is the dramatic reduction in the reimbursement rate from about 11 to 14 cents per kilowatt hour to what will end up being about 3 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour. But if you look at all the different provisions of the bill, of which there are six major problems with the bill, cumulatively, they will greatly discourage investment on the part of customers using their own hard-earned money to invest in solar energy, whether they are a homeowner, a business owner, a pastor, a mayor, or a county commissioner. It just all around will be very discouraging for investing in solar energy.
I had a chance this last week to talk with at least one business person about the Senate bill, and he's very, very concerned from the standpoint of being involved with a company that in turn helps make up leases for the people that can set up wind turbines in their properties, very much the wind turbine size, like the one that is located here in Northwest Indiana that's outside the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union Hall on Mississippi Street. It's not a huge one, not like the ones you see along I-65 or along U.S. 41 in south of us in Western Indiana, but still they're wind turbines that are generating power and in turn being able to sell back that electricity to the utility companies. And this fellow was very concerned about the fact that if the measure goes through, that his business would probably have to close. And I know that there are other businesses in Northwest Indiana as well, too, that deal in not only wind turbines, but also deal in solar panels as well. They, too, have done very well because of the sale to homeowners and to businesses. They're going to see probably a cutback in business. They may also have to close as well, too. If you've gotten the similar type of reaction from other businesses that deal in solar as well as in wind power?
Absolutely. I mean, we have relationships with a lot of different solar companies, and they are all very concerned. Just to put things into a broader perspective, solar is no longer a peripheral industry in our country. There are 200,000 jobs in solar energy in the United States. And the sector is growing 12 times faster than the private sector. This is important for Indiana because we should be making sure that our policy climate is as attractive to customer-owned generation as possible so that we can get a slice of this fast-growing pie. But what it turns out is that the public policy that is being proposed in SB 309 would send Indiana backwards, and that is a contrast to what is happening in all the neighboring states, Ohio, Michigan, and Illinois, where Republican governors are proactively either enshrining policy into law or expanding policy to make it a more attractive climate for investing in solar energy. So we would certainly be putting Indiana in a worse off position if SB 309 were to pass.
And if that's the case, you see a lot of these businesses, like ones that have established here in Northwest Indiana, ended up going perhaps to Illinois because it's close by, or ones that are over in other sections of the state going to Ohio if this bill passes?
Sure, that's definitely a risk that companies that just don't see a good domestic market for solar energy are going to, you know, have very good reason to move to another state. Sure, they're going to make their decisions based on a variety of things, property values, tax climate. But when it comes to renewable energy-specific legislation or regulation, without question, our neighboring states would have much better policy. And therefore, the ability to be near their customers would be a lot more likely in those neighboring states than in Indiana.
What are the utility companies across the state, NIPSCO, Duke Energy, Vectren, the like, what do they have to say about this measure? Why do they seem to be in support of it, in your estimation?
Well, they bring up a couple of points. One, they characterize this as solar customers are imposing a subsidy on other customers, and that's not correct because any study that has been done, any independent study that's unaffiliated with either the utility lobby or with the public interest community, those studies done by state public utility commissions all show that the benefits that solar provides to the grid far exceed the cost that it imposes on the grid. And therefore, solar is a net benefit to the grid. And that flies in the face of the argument that it's somehow a subsidy. The other piece that's talked about is that solar net metering is an incentive, and because solar has declined in price significantly, why do we need this incentive? But the problem is that's not the right way to think about net metering. Net metering is simply a way by which public utility commissions, of which 43 have weighed in on this issue, 43 of our 50 states, it's just the common practice for how you go about valuing what solar brings to the grid. And solar brings a lot to the grid. It helps to offset generation, transmission, and distribution costs of utilities. It helps to offset pollution control costs of utilities. It helps to improve the grid security of a utility company. So it provides a lot of benefits to the grid, and it just simply makes sense to provide solar customers for the value that they bring to the grid.
We mentioned at the outset of our conversation here that State Representative Ed Soliday, who's a Republican, Val Prezzo's, his committee is to take up the bill as it's come from the Senate into the House in a hearing on Wednesday. What do you and others who have their concerns about this Senate Bill 309 have to say about coming up at the hearing, and what do you hope to be able to bring up before Representative Soliday?
Well, I think before the committee in general, the intent is to dispel these notions that solar is, again, a subsidy or that net metering is some kind of unneeded incentive. We need to put things back in perspective that every type of generation that is plugged into the grid has to be provided a certain value, whether that's coal or gas or nuclear or renewables. And net metering is an appropriate method to value the benefits that solar brings to the grid. And for us to radically change policy, which is what 309 would do, mm-hmm. would destabilize the 45 companies in our state that are in the solar business, and it would really detract companies from investing in our state. And why would we do that when Governor Holcomb and others talk about economic development being our number one priority? It seems like we are really making a huge inconsistency between what we say we want to do as a state as far as public policy is concerned and what we do. And that's why the best thing for the legislature to do is to let this bill die, because, again, it's putting our solar industry in a worse-off position compared to existing law. And furthermore, it's just dramatically discouraging people from controlling their own energy costs by putting up all these different roadblocks to customer-owned solar generation.
Now, have you or anybody else that has shown their concern about this Senate Bill 309 had a chance to talk with State Representative Soliday about this to voice your concerns?
Well, we have talked. I've had the chance to talk with several members of the committee, a few more planned, and I'd certainly like to reach out to Representative Soliday. I think his views have tended to be pretty aligned with the investor-owned utilities, but we welcome dialogue with everyone.
Do you think that, by saying that, you think that maybe that Representative Soliday's made up his mind on this measure?
That's the sense that we've gotten from others, and that's also consistent with how he has voted on similar utility policies in the past, including HB 1320 that was advanced two sessions ago, which, like SB 309, would have completely drastically altered the policy climate for solar energy. We're unsure why his positions on renewable energy are not favorable.
What do you, as the representative from the Hoosier Environmental Council, and I'm sure other members of the other organizations here in Indiana that are concerned about the environment, about taking advantage of natural energy as opposed to using natural gas or coal to create electricity, what do you hope that you can do that if this measure unfortunately makes it through, has it gotten through the Senate, if it makes it through the House, what do you feel you can do at least to counter it?
Well, I mean, we will keep, amplifying our voice. There's never been an energy bill in the decade that I've been working on Indiana public policy. There's never been an energy bill that has attracted more controversy. I've talked to Republican legislative aides who say that they're getting dozens and dozens of calls opposing the bill, but no calls in favor of the bill. So we would like lawmakers to really reflect the will of the people. And, those who take the time to call are people who are genuinely concerned about this bill. And again, overwhelmingly, they're opposed to it. So we hope that they listen to their constituents and they decide to put this bill to bed. An organization like ours, the Hoosier Environmental Council, is not wanting to be an obstructionist. Our job is to ask the tough question, does the policy make our state better off or worse off? SB 309 makes our state worse off because it puts these six different roadblocks to investing in solar energy. And by doing so, it will depress investment in customer-owned solar energy, and that in turn will deter companies from expanding or coming to Indiana in the realm of solar energy. And that is wrong when we are a state that is trying to become more and more attractive to different types of industries to help deal with the unemployment problems we face, particularly in low-income communities.
Jesse Carbonda is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, and I'm sure, Jesse, that you and many other representatives from the HEC and other organizations are going to be at that committee hearing on Wednesday at the State House when the House Republican lawmakers take a look at this measure, among them, of course, Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso. Jesse, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this Senate Bill 309, your concerns about it from the HEC standpoint and others as well, too. And we will find out later and get your reaction, what happens after the committee hearing. It'll, of course, come up before the full Indiana House sometime or another before the session ends. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today. At the State House, the Senate sponsor of a bill that would ensure freedom of the press for students says that he anticipates a relatively easy path through his chamber. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that it would give student journalists the same press freedoms that professionals have.
The proposed legislation would affect student-produced media in grades 5 and up and says schools cannot suppress it unless it's libelous or profane. House sponsor, Republican Ed Clear, says journalism education is more important than ever.
And evidence shows that journalism programs that are free from censorship promote better learning while also providing valuable reporting, and commentary.
Courts in the last few decades have frequently curtailed student constitutional rights, but Senate sponsor of the bill, Republican Brant Hirschman, views this issue differently.
This is a matter of trying to ensure that young journalists understand and respect the power of the First Amendment, of our constitutional guarantees, and to do so in a professional manner.
The bill passed out of the House with only 4 votes against it. It's now in the Senate Education Committee. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
This legislative session, a record 11 proposals have been addressing the use of cannabis. While most of them never got a hearing, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that 2 are still moving through the legislature at this point, and one of them could become Indiana's first medical cannabis law.
Indiana is one of 6 states that has not passed any form of medical cannabis legislation. But for the past 7 years, senators have sought Dr. Trent Jones' testimony on the topic. Here's Jones speaking from California last January via Skype.
The longer you wait on these children with catastrophic seizures, the more damage you do to their ability to develop.
Jones is a Hoosier native and works now with the National Institute for Cannabis and Endocannabinoid Research, or NICER. He strongly advised lawmakers to legalize a form of medical cannabis to treat epilepsy.
This is the 7th time I've personally testified, and for CBD and industrial hemp in general.
CBD stands for cannabidiol, also known as hemp oil. It's a non-psychoactive cannabis with low tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, so people can't get high. This bill is in the Senate, and it has support. A related bill defining CBD products as having no more than 0.03 THC also passed the House. Bobby Joe Young lobbies for cannabis legislation in Indiana. While industrial hemp is legal for research, she says medicinal cannabis bills have never seen this much traction.
The reason that politicians are concerned is, in our opinion, strictly wording. So just in generally, we're breaking the stigma with the politicians saying, hey, look at the education, look at the medical background, look at the research.
She and fellow lobbyist David Phipps say public opinion is changing and the stigma is fading.
Bill similar to Senate Bill 15 has passed unanimously through the House. We expect the same thing to happen with Senate Bill 15. The next obstacle we expect for Senate Bill 15 will be the governor's desk.
Governor Eric Holcomb has said he has no plans to expand legal drug use, especially in light of the state's opioid epidemic. The Controlled Substances Act of 1970 still classifies all forms of cannabis as Schedule I drugs, and a recent study did not definitively prove the benefits of medicinal cannabis. At the same hearing that took testimony from Dr. Trent Jones in January, Republican Senator Aaron Freeman says he worries about the gray lines.
I mean, law enforcement have to have, in my view, clear guidelines as to is this legal or not, and I just worry how is it that they're going to know where this product was grown.
Indiana State Senator Karen Tallien has proposed cannabis-related legislation for the past 7 years and is a co-author on the CBD bill for epilepsy.
After a number of years, somebody's finally listened.
Tallien wants a provision added to the bill and hopes to pave the way for more medical cannabis legislation.
There's a study for the health committee during the summer to look and see about other conditions that, you know, may benefit.
That may be a lot of conditions if advocates like Dr. Trent Jones from NICER are right. This is more of his testimony to the Senate committee via Skype.
CBD is clearly effective in diseases from autism, epilepsy, chronic pain syndromes, osteoarthritis, autoimmune, rheumatoid, some cancers. Opiate replacement therapy is a huge opportunity.
As the debate continues, many are watching it closely. Betty Jo Boucher lives in Fishers. She's a mother and doctor and says her friend from Colorado offered to buy her some CBD hemp oil after her son was diagnosed with primary generalized epilepsy 2 years ago.
I fear I would go to jail for helping my son.
She says she'd like to know more about CBD for her 12-year-old. She worries about him being on so many pharmaceuticals.
If anything, we just want the opportunity to see if it works. You know, let's do some clinical trials. Let's do proof of concept. You know, I'm a doctor. I believe in science.
Senate Bill 15 would include a registry for approved patients. The proposal will be heard in the House in the coming weeks. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Indiana House Minority Leader and State Representative Scott Pilat of Michigan City got together with reporters on Friday at the State House. And among the topics he took up was the cigarette tax increase that is being proposed to go to health care instead of being used as a backfill to the infrastructure work. That is, if congressional Republicans successfully pass their health care plan.
I think there's going to have to be some public commitment made that if the cigarette tax is going to be increased in any way, there has to be a firm allocation of those dollars to health care needs. There's just too much uncertainty in Washington, and now it looks like they may have to make a fresh run at an entirely new bill that for political reasons may become even more onerous for us here in Indiana if we're going to sustain this HIP 2.0 program.
Pilat says that House Bill 1001, which is the state biennial budget bill, had an increase in the cigarette tax as the backstop for transportation initiatives, as he put it. And he says that money is going to have to shift to health care, and concerns about the Affordable Care Act being replaced and how that is going to affect HIP 2.0.
You will note that the state budget had a $1 cigarette tax increase in it. I have suspected that that revenue placeholder is there as a backstop for some of the transportation initiatives. That option, to the extent it exists, is going to probably be taken off the table based on what happens with health care.
HIP 2.0 is really part of the Affordable Care Act, and the Republican health plan that is coming into the U.S. House of Representatives is causing concern among Indiana government leaders about how they can preserve HIP 2.0's coverage to many Hoosiers. And Pilat talked with the reporters on Friday about the letter that is going out from the State House to Indiana's congressional delegation.
Within the next day, many members of the House of Representatives from my caucus will be sending a letter to our federal delegation, which includes our 9 U.S. representatives and our 2 U.S. senators, urging that whatever they decide in the U.S. Congress about the future of health care, that they make it possible for us to preserve this program. It is too important, and the power is currently in their hands.
U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly faced a mostly favorable crowd of several hundred people at a town hall meeting in Muncie over the weekend. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stephanie Weekman tells us that Donnelly was asked by a number of proposals from the Trump administration. And she has the story.
By the clapping and head nodding, most people agreed with Senator Joe Donnelly's dislike of the GOP-written American Health Care Act and his views on climate change science, new technology jobs, and getting more Americans to turn out to vote. There was a single round of boos, but not for Donnelly. Nathan Crapo of Muncie asked Donnelly to, quote, do your job and commit to voting for Neil Gorsuch, President Donald Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. On a scratchy microphone, Donnelly calmed down those booing, saying everyone has a right to an opinion.
And my duty involves actually listening to him answer questions that are put before him in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Gorsuch's congressional confirmation hearings begin Monday. When asked about President Trump's budget, Donnelly said it was meant to be an initial document and said he'd work with his colleagues in Congress to stop proposed cuts to social programs, the arts, and medical research.
I promise you it'll be changed. It'll be changed to become much more sensible.
While thanking Donnelly for holding a town hall meeting, Kathy Badger of Anderson received a round of applause for invoking the name of Indiana's other U.S. Senator, Republican Todd Young.
Would you go down and please see Senator Young and tell him he also works for the state of Indiana?
An online petition and protesters in Bloomington recently asked Young to hold a similar town hall meeting. Young's office has not responded. According to the senator's social media, he has spent time in the Evansville area, visiting with military veterans and a domestic violence prevention organization. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman in Muncie.
Two mass transit projects here in Northwest Indiana could lose some significant federal funding under the proposed Trump administration budget. The budget issued by the administration is calling for substantial cuts in federal spending, including the close to the Department of Transportation. The concern is the cuts would eliminate the program that would provide funds from the federal government for the South Shore Line's West Lake Corridor and the Double Track Northwest Indiana projects. The recent cost estimates show that the West Lake project would require more than $300 million in federal funds, and the Double Track project between Gary and Michigan City would require about $145,000. And it's Monday, which means it's time once again for John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jeff Brown, professor of jazz
and
yes.
All that jazz.
There you go.
At Valparaiso University. And Jeff, you have been on the music scene in Northwest Indiana since since Northwest Indiana was invented.
Thank you.
I believe you invented the saxophone.
Yes, well, Albert Sax as well.
not that you play the saxophone.
Well, I did in college, but since that time I'm primarily a percussionist and pianist. And
So, and you're very well known throughout our region, I would say, for the Jeff Brown Trio.
Well, thank you.
Awfully
doing
good
many
music that we'll be hearing at the final, prior to the final concert of the Northwest Indiana Symphony on April 27th, when we have our final 75th birthday celebration that evening.
Beautiful. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
So if anybody wants to come, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just my pitch. But we're really here to pitch today the 32nd annual Valparaiso University Jazz Fest. And you founded the Jazz Fest, didn't you?
Yes. This is our 32nd year. And it's really, truly grown from a day-and-a-half festival to 5 to 6 days, depending on the year. And it focuses on a combination of both student performances and professional performances, both student-wise, both collegiate and high school. And on Monday and Wednesday this year, we have more than 300 high school students from all over Lake Porter and LaPorte County coming in to perform. And it's an interesting opportunity for them because most of the time, they're doing these festivals and being adjudicated and things like this. This is a festival that they come to and just for the love of performing and in a professional environment. A new thing this year is Tuesday night. What we've been doing is we're combining with the Valparaiso Concert Association, and we're doing an interesting type of combination of performance and indeed dance music for all ages. And it's an interesting new type of thing for us, for the festival for sure.
So people get to get up and dance.
Exactly.
Which sometimes I'm sure they have felt like doing throughout the years.
Exactly. Well, sometimes they do, and it's encouraged. And this was a brand new type of venue for us, so we're looking forward to it. We're going to have a vocalist, and we're going to have the VU ballroom dancers, the student group that will be helping out. So it's a little different type of thing for us.
Would you say that that the appreciation for and participation among young people in jazz is rising, or how? What do you sense among young people? You have 300, you say, who are going to be performing. That sounds like a lot of kids.
Jazz education, I feel, is in a good place in Northwest Indiana. We have some great programs all over Lake County, LaPorte County, Porter County. There's Chesterton. There's Portage. There's Valparaiso. And I think that as jazz education grows worldwide, that it's influencing. You know, you don't want to educate just everybody to become a performer.
Right.
What we do is giving a broad scope of just understanding of the music, so when these people graduate or go into whatever profession they're going into, they support the music.
You're a Munster boy, aren't you?
That's where I grew up,
And I know three Munster boys who have become professional. Well, one who's graduating senior this year, who's going to study saxophone.
Okay.
And two who are in their mid-20s, mid to late 20s now, who grew up in Munster. And they have pursued careers in professional, and they're brothers.
Yeah, and my father was the band director in Munster for many years.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so consequently, it's in my blood, that's for sure.
So who's your big name this year?
We've got, on Saturday night, the Chicago Afro-Latin Jazz Ensemble, which is a really interesting ensemble. They perform in various different sizes, from a quintet, quartet, to a huge big band, and they're going to be coming in with a 20-piece band. Very interesting instrumentation. They have percussion-wise, they have drum set, congas, timbales. Interesting mix of horns and saxophones, as I said, and they do all kinds of great Argentinian tangos, merengues, bombas, flamenco, reggae, a little combination of literally everything. And that is really becoming a big part of a lot of the festivals around the world. On Friday night, we have Victor Wooten coming in. Victor is one of the world's greatest bassists, mm-hmm. and he was with Bella Fleck and the Flecktones for many years. He's an amazing technician. Bass Player Magazine for 3 or 4 times have named him the Bass Player of the Year, et cetera, like that.
Well, Jeff, thank you for being here to tell us about the Jazz Fest, the 32nd annual, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
John Kane with Eye on the Arts, talking with Jeff Brown about the upcoming 32nd annual Valparaiso University Jazz Festival. You can join us on Regionally Speaking on Mondays for Arts Eye on the Arts Conversations. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, a conversation with Valparaiso Parks and Recreation Director John Seibert. We hope you'll join us for that.